and welcome back to the NJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I am your host. Today, the topic is cirrhosis and how we can improve patient outcomes and reduce emergency admissions. Associate Professor Alan Wigg is a gastroenterologist and hepatologist at Flinders Medical Centre in Adelaide. Dr. Jayamani Ramachandran is a PhD candidate and the lead author on research published in the NJA. Alan and Jaya are my special guests on the pod today. Why did this research need doing? Where was the gap in the knowledge?
I suppose the gap was that this was a disease that's sort of been forgotten about, but was becoming an increasing problem at a hospital level because our wards, particularly in gastroenterology and general medicine, were starting to fill up with these patients, these chronic liver failure patients who had very complex problems that were sort of being patched up but returning very, very quickly. And so little by little, our whole sort of gastro ward or large parts of the ward were becoming full of decompensated cirrhosis patients from a variety of causes, hep C, alcohol, fatty liver disease.
What is the definition of decompensated cirrhosis as compared to cirrhosis?
Well, cirrhosis is a state where you have chronic inflammation in the liver leading to scarring. Like any sort of chronic inflammatory process, it can lead to scarring. Now, that scarring is not necessarily a problem if the liver can retain its normal function. But there becomes a tipping point where the scarring gets to a critical phase where the liver starts to fail. And the liver will fail when it reduces its function by perhaps 75% or so. And the sorts of manifestations of that failure we call decompensation. And they can be a variety of things. They can be what we call synthetic failure, where the liver stops making proteins like coagulation proteins, which lead to bleeding problems or coagulopathy. Lack of albumin, and that's together with circulatory changes, because the blood can't flow smoothly through the liver because the liver's got a lot of resistance. That creates what we call portal hypertension, and that can lead to problems like ascites, is fluid in the abdomen, and varices and variceal bleeding. All of those problems lead patients to admission on wards.
Perhaps, Jaya, you can explain a little bit about the design of the study. How did you set this up? What are the differences between the two arms of treatment?
We have what is called a chronic liver failure program, mm-hmm. where these liver patients are managed by a consultant who has got special interest in liver diseases. So there's a thorough inpatient assessment during which the patients are seen by the consultant and discharge plans are made. When they get discharged, there is a post-discharge care by liver nurses who follow the sick patient, and they offer, if the patients are started on diuretics, they are followed up by frequent blood tests. See, what happens is when they are discharged from the hospital, they come back with complications and side effects of the treatment as well, which needs close monitoring, possible unless they come back to the clinic. In between clinic appointments, when the patients are managed in a chronic liver failure program, continuity of care is maintained. So we wanted to see, with so much of resources, what are we achieving with readmissions as well as the survival of the patient in the long run, compared to a hospital where there is a standard care, where there is no exclusive post-discharge monitoring. The patients, if they fall sick, they either come through the GP or via the emergency services, rather than having a contact person when they have problems. Model of care, which is different between the two centres.
What were your major results?
What we found was the occurrence of emergency, liver-related emergency admissions were fewer when there is a coordinated care like this, mm-hmm. and also the patients tended to survive longer with our model of care compared to the standard care.
Alan, did those results surprise you?
No, not at all, because, we didn't sort of pluck this study from anywhere. We'd already studied a randomised way in a pilot trial several years before within our own unit, and we'd examined the effects of this model of care versus the standard, and we'd found that there certainly was an enormous shift of admissions towards more elective style admissions, and we'd seen a lot better adherence to the protocols and the evidence-based protocols that we were trying to get patients to do. And we also saw a signal of mortality as well, that there was a non-significant, but a trend towards lower mortality in the group that were actively managed. So on that basis, because we'd had sort of difficulty sort of funding and running more multi-centre, large, properly powered trials, this is probably the next step for us to look at a cohort comparison between two similar hospitals in all respects other than perhaps this one.
Are you looking as far ahead as thinking this program should be rolled out nationally, or are you just thinking we need more trials.
I mean, we like to be evidence-based, and we think that the evidence we have is good, but it's not sort of level one type evidence. To get to that level, we do need to have multi-centre randomised controlled trials.
Assuming multi-centre trials continue to show the benefits of this, are there other barriers, do you think, to getting this rolled out nationally?
The tension has always been trying to come up with funds to employ the nursing component of this model. And so that always involves an investment. But what we have shown in that initial pilot control, that investment is very worthwhile. There are certainly, cost benefits and to that service by managing patients more as elective rather than emergency, because the emergency admissions are incredibly costly. Our analysis shows that patients can stay up to 10 days and they will cost a health service up to $20,000 per admission. Our perspective, and I think the data that we've done showing that, suggests that it is a very cost-effective investment, but you still have to argue that case, with every health service. So potentially, the other aspect is trying to change policy and get sort of endorsement for this as the standard of care at a national sort of level. I think that would help facilitate that sort of funding. We need, obviously, to argue that more powerfully.
I'm chatting today with Alan Wigg and Jaya Ramachandran, who have co-authored new research on cirrhosis of the liver, which you can find at mja.com.au. That's the research, not the cirrhosis. Like all our research, it is open access. Are there ways of preventing cirrhosis developing into decompensated cirrhosis, and is that part of the program?
I think in our setting, and I think in most settings, Australia, alcohol still remains the number one cause of cirrhosis and decompensation. So any public health measures that will help reduce alcohol consumption are an important part of that plan. Also, in terms of the other main cause of cirrhosis, that's hepatitis C. And certainly at a government level, the government has funded unrestricted access to Hep C treatment. That will have and is starting to have significant effects on preventing cirrhosis compensation. But the problem will be making sure those patients who have Hep C are detected early and treated early. They don't progress to cirrhosis. I think the other thing that's emerging as a problem for the future is the fatty liver disease and obesity become the major cause of cirrhosis in our community and decompensation. So again, the approach to that will be a public health approach to try and reduce obesity in our community.
If you had a magic wand, what would you do first?
I mean, I think the low-hanging fruit has been the Hep C treatment. I mean, I think that's, it's a revolutionary treatment. It's funded now. There's no restrictions on anyone who's Hep C can get it. So I think that is a game changer, and it's happening before us. And I think it's just a matter of getting that education message out to general practitioners and doctors and patients about those new treatments that are available to be given in 2 to 3 months with 95% cure rates without any side effects. That's a very important message to get, to doctors who don't deal with this every day in their general practices and to patients who might have risk factors and should be screened.
What about you, Jaya? What would you do?
I think there is no one-size-fits-all. As Alan said, multiple things, hepatitis C, obesity, these are I think maybe after this, obesity will be a major thing that needs to be controlled so that the incidence of cirrhosis can come down.
I just think that the results are pretty striking. If you look at how similar these units are, we can't control everything in an uncontrolled, non-randomized study, but the units are almost carbon copies of each other, just on the other opposite side of town. And I mean, they have roughly the same bed numbers, the same ICU, the same emergency, the same units. And really the model that differs, but we look at the reductions in the liver-related emergency admissions, and they are 48% lower, which is highly statistically significant. We look at the mortality outcomes, and we see that, your risk of death in one unit is 2.5 times higher than the other. Your three-year survival in one unit is 67% and the other unit is 37%. I mean, those are quite striking. We hope that rather than being threatened or ignored, that this problem's taken seriously, because we think there is a solution to this problem to some extent. And we think it's, that's hopefully why it's been highlighted by your journal and you're interested in it. And hopefully we can get that message out, gather the more evidence and start looking after these patients better.
Indeed.
The problem is of health services delivery. The solution seems relatively simple, but that doesn't mean it's not worthwhile.
Is there the workforce there already waiting to be employed? Or will more nurses need to be trained, for example?
I think to some extent there is. I mean, we've gone in gastroenterology and hepatology, we've gone through a generation of establishing nurses to treat hepatitis C. That really was essential in the days of hepatitis C treatment when we were using very toxic and complex drugs like interferon. And, you know, the workforce sort of grew around that problem. And as, you know, with the march of science, those treatments have disappeared and we have much more effective and easy to use treatment. To some extent, there's opportunity to deploy that nursing workforce in hepatology from Hep C towards what is the current challenge of the hour, which is managing these chronic liver failure patients and preventing their admissions.
Quite a high proportion of our listeners are GPs. What's the message for them in this study?
The thing is not to give up hope, but not to say that, you know, generally the idea is that if somebody develops liver failure, there's a lot of pessimism around it and can be done. They only tend to fall apart. It's not like that. With aggressive management and close monitoring, it is, and by adhering to guidelines, it is possible to prolong survival and avoid emergency admissions.
No, I think the GP is in a very difficult situation here, because often these are not patients that, you know, like diabetes, that the GP will see very often or have a great deal of experience or confidence with. What happens is, you know, they need to be part of the team, and the hospital needs to integrate their management a lot better with the GP. And we talk about the valley of death when we sort of discharge patients from hospital, and because you know, we can't see patients weekly in our clinics because of the burden and blockages in our clinics in public healthcare. You know, we need to be able to rely on GPs for out-of-hospital care, and they need to be able to rely on us, and we need to be integrated. And that sort of integration is the valley of death and the problem which this model tries to solve. So that's the message, is just better integration, and also that there is a huge amount of evidence for very effective interventions in these patients. So there are very effective interventions. It's about trying to implement them better.
Perfect.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you both for your time. Thank you, Jaya, for coming
as
well. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.nja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.